Welcome to the Farm to Table Talk podcast and conversations about our food and how it's grown from ranch, harbor, or farm to your table. I'm Roger Wasson, and this is Farm to Table Talk.
Well, sometimes it seems that beef cattle production gets more than its share of blame for everything from climate change to the poor state of our health. For a perspective from the ranch, we sat down for a visit with two California cattle ranchers, Jack Hansen, owner of Willow Creek Ranch near Susanville, California, and Dina Moore, partner in Lone Star Ranch near Neyland, California. Their passion for raising cattle is clear.
Our process, and I think what's really important to me to share about it is its stewardship. We are fortunate enough to be able to raise cattle, and with that comes a huge responsibility. And I always like to share that with folks, is we do what we do because we're passionate. We're passionate about our livestock and taking care of our livestock. So in our case, we are what's called a traditional cow-calf operation. We have mother cows who calve. Those calves grow to an age of 6 to 9 months, somewhere in that range, depending upon our resources and all of that sort of stuff, and we wean them. At that point, we sell calves off the ranch. We do keep other calves, but from there, they go to other folks who continue to raise them. That's what we do. It is critical to us that we are able to produce a product that is in high demand. I always share with folks that the very real reality of my business operation, and this is a business, is that we, my husband and I, market a commodity. For a period of time, I did sell grass-finished beef at a farmer's market and lost a lot of money. And it was a wonderful growing, learning experience, but I do sell a commodity, and I am have to take a market price for that. We have periods of drought, whether it's a winter no season of grass growth or a summer no season of grass growth, so we cannot produce a product year-round that we're able to finish on grass. However, having said that, fortunately, I'm in an area of California that is unique, and we've got a coastal system, and they can down on the coast finish and raise grass finished beef. So our natural surrounding is conducive to that. But we ranch up in the hills, and that's not something we can do. The other part of it, too, is that if you are selling a grass-finished product, it's like any other business venture. You have to develop that product. You have to develop your logo. You have to put an enormous amount of overhead costs into building this venture, this business. We also can only have meat processed at USDA-inspected plants. And again, I think as we were talking earlier, that's a big part of what we do as livestock producers is work closely and under the guidance when our animals go to be processed under USDA standards and sanctions. So it's like with any other small business that you're a startup business, grass-finished business is a whole different sort of business entity that's different than our cow-calf operation.
Well, I was going to answer, Dana, for the many people that said, well, why don't you just grow cattle this way? I mean, so you're limited by where you are, what the situation is where you are. Jack, what's describe your operation?
Our operation, we're a traditional cow-calf operation. We have the mother cows, have the calves, and then market those calves at some point in time in their life cycle. We're specifically connected to a partnership with Harris Ranch here in California, and so our calves will go down there, and hopefully we will receive a premium, a slight premium over market, because we comply with the criteria that they have for our partnership. They have a certain number of things that we have to comply with, and of course they all focus on selling a healthy, safe, quality product. One interesting aspect I'd like to speak about is that there is no one-size-fits-all. We're all in different areas. We all have different climate. We all have different assets and so on that we have to deal with and different liabilities or challenges. And to emphasize that, my wife's family, she's a fourth-generation rancher. Our children are fourth-generation ranchers on her side of the family. And she has a sister and a brother. So there are three separate operations represented in my wife's family. And they're all different. And we all live within 30 miles of each other. And each one fits that specific operation. We do have one of them, her sister, has a farm-to-fork operation. They market at the farmers markets in Reno and so forth. Her brother is what I would consider a least-cost operator, which is extremely successful. And then, as I said, we fall somewhere in between. I think one thing that I'd notice well on the grass-fed versus a conventional fed animal, Roger, first there have been studies that indicate there's actually less CO2 emissions from a conventionally fed animal versus a grass-fed, only because that grass-fed animal has to be much older when harvested, not much older, but substantially older when harvested. And so, you know, I think there are a number of different ways to look at grass-fed versus conventional. Neither one is necessarily right or wrong, but there are substantial differences.
I've got to ask you a somewhat non-scientific question here, too, because when you look at the issues and the effect that people are worried about now on climate change, on the global warming, and the cattle industry's contribution, I mean, crudely, is this just because cattle being ruminants, either they're passing gas or belching, and it just is a part of this whole process that's natural to cattle?
You know, if you consider the carbon sequestration that occurs, especially in Dina's area with trees, obviously, but even in our area, if we consider the carbon sequestration on the resources on which we raise those cattle, I dare say that we're certainly carbon neutral in my estimation, and I think that the science, and it was generally ignored. Obviously, the UN had its long shadow or whatever that discussion was on the methane and so on that comes from the cattle. I think when we get down to the hard science, the contribution of methane and carbon into the atmosphere is substantially less than what is actually sequestered by the resources we use.
You're going to leave me hanging out there with my comments about passing gas and belching, Captain.
Well, I think Jack answered it really well. Again, I think it gets back to a science question rather than decisions or based on emotions. And I think oftentimes those are sort of what comes out in the public arena, are those sort of ideas or thoughts. But the other part of the equation, too, is Jack was talking about carbon sequestration, was I was thinking about our range. And I was thinking about managing our range, and I was thinking about the roots of the plants in our range. We manage our range for a healthy range. We are grass farmers. And I think if you were to do studies to look at how we can or how we are managing our range and the benefits or values that plays in the whole carbon model, I think we could be having a different conversation as to the values that we can reap from grazing cattle in a manner that helps the rangeland.
Which raises another question. What would happen if there are no cattle there? You know, you're in areas where somebody might say, gee, I wish you would just all have, you know, raised broccoli and cauliflower. I suspect that might be difficult for you to be a broccoli farmer in your territory.
Well, and I think that Jack can speak to it as well. We are in a rugged environment. The only thing that's grown successfully now in that rugged environment is marijuana. And Jack knew I was going to take us there. I mean, I can't, in this day and age, speak of what we do without touches us so deeply on so many levels. What we are seeing, interestingly enough, is an increase in elk herds. And so I really firmly believe that if man weren't here and our cattle weren't here, there would be something else here, elk. So, you know, I just don't think that there wouldn't be something. The other thing that I thought of as you were posing that question is, oh my gosh, look at the wildfires we have had in California. I think that cattle play a critical role in helping to reduce brush encroachment, that sort of thing, in our rangelands. So I think it's a complex question that's not easily answered, but there are a number of different factors that play into it.
No, I certainly agree with what Dina suggested. I do think that the wildfire cycle and so on that we've seen in California is especially exacerbated by the drought, obviously. If we were to control the understory in a number of these environments, whether it be by mechanical means and biomass and so on, or whether it be by a little bit more judicious controlled burns, which were obviously they were used by the Native Americans, if you will, a couple hundred years ago and used successfully in order to avoid catastrophic fires. And cattle grazing obviously plays a role in that. I think around Lake County, if they had had a little more cattle grazing on some of that brush country around Lake County, that fire would have been a lot less intense. So I think there's truly a place for cattle. You mentioned broccoli and cauliflower, and Dina alluded to it. We couldn't grow broccoli, cauliflower. There aren't many crops that we can grow in our neck of the woods. And I think humbly, producing food and fiber for the population of the world is truly an honorable profession, and cattle raising is just a part of that equation, if you will.
Well, you said it well, both of you. And appreciate having the chance to have a cup of coffee with you and have this conversation this morning. I've been talking with Dina Moore and Jack Hansen about the cattle industry and raising cattle and some of the issues that you face. And one thing comes through in our conversation, too, is I think you both really both believe in your industry, but this feels like there's some optimism and you see some ways to feel good about the business going forward, too.
Our ranch work is really seasonal, and so this time of year is a quieter time. I really feel one of the great values of being a rancher, at least for us, is we sort of get to work around daylight. So this time of year, we'll be getting up, 6:30 to 7, sleeping in. My husband and I will start the morning with a cup of coffee together and sort of map out our day, that sort of thing. He then heads out of the house and goes to feed livestock. I generally head into the office and look at my computer. As I've gotten older, I've discovered that, we don't need to work. We can just volunteer our services. And so I'm fortunate enough to have been involved with a number of different organizations over the years, and it seems like that can take up a lot of your time. So I'll generally start my morning this time of year looking at my computer and sort of, looking at responding to emails, that sort of thing. If it were summer, it would be entirely different. On our ranching operation, we also harvest timber. So my husband is out the door early in the morning, and that season I'm responsible for the cattle. So I probably will be on horseback first thing in the morning that time of year.
What happens at your place?
A normal day, I'd probably get up around 4 to 5, 5 o'clock in the morning and head to the kitchen, obviously, turn on the TV, catch up on some of the ag shows in the early morning and have a little breakfast. At this time of year, we're here in the middle of December, rolling towards the last half of December, so obviously we're feeding cattle at our end of the country. Our cattle, the majority of our cattle would head down to the Sacramento Valley this time of year in order to eat some of the green grass down there as opposed to feeding them hay at home. But we always have a few head at home that we've got to take care of. So our normal winter day is feeding cattle most of the morning. I do that with one of our sons who is on the ranch working with us. Our other son, lives on the ranch as well, but is in agricultural banking in town in Susanville. And but that's normally what a day would be. If we were here in the summer months, obviously, the primary early morning task in the summer months is irrigation. If we don't irrigate our property, we don't grow very much. So that's kind of what it – and each and every day is different, no doubt about it. We may have the best laid plans of mice and men sitting there in front of us at 7 o'clock in the morning, but I can assure you by the end of the day, it will have changed. So,
you know, one of the things that struck me that you both said when you get started with the day is, Dana, you were saying you get up and you turn your computer on. Jack, you were saying you get your cup of coffee and you turn the TV on, and you know you're getting information. I mean, you're in a fairly remote area, as you both are, and not a lot of people around you compared to what we have here, for example, in the Bay Area. But it's brought right to you, so you're able to be there on the ranch, and you're kind of observing what people are saying about the beef industry, about ranchers, and you sit there sometimes, I would imagine, and over the years, we've ended up having people that say you should stay away from beef, stay away from cattle, just because. And some people are against the idea of animals being in the food system. And then we went through some large period of time where it was about, well, if you eat too much beef, it's going to be high in cholesterol. And then there's been... there's been cancer studies from time to time that are critical, and it just seems like it's just pounding. And now we're finding that that more and more they're saying, well, stay away from consuming cattle. It's because of it's contributing to global warming. And there's been a big controversy this current year, just at the dietary guidelines, about whether they were going to suggest that people just need to consume less meat, and they wanted to make part of the dietary guidelines. It's become a huge controversy, and the report has come out, that the report's coming out, and the Secretary of Agriculture said, well, we're not going to talk about that, and so forth. And so, of course, everybody's talking about it. So it's this, and I'm just curious, and it's interesting because of beef. Beef is a great food, but it's also used to describe a grudge or a disagreement, and if you had a beef with some of these comments, I'm curious what kind of reactions, what tends to make your blood boil when you're hearing the misunderstandings and criticisms of your livelihood? Jack, do you want to start?
I'm not sure, Roger, if my blood necessarily boils on a number of those issues, and obviously we have a very strong industrial organization, the checkout program and so on, that counters, you know, a number of these issues that get into the press. I think probably if I were to suggest one thing that irritates me to a certain extent is when some of our detractors or the detractors of any food or group or something makes a strong attempt to make that judgment call for everybody. I think that most of us, as long as a substance is legal, you should have the opportunity to make that decision for yourself as to whether you include beef in your diet or whether you include fish or whether you want to be a vegetarian or a vegan. I don't necessarily have a criticism with any of those approaches, but I do have, sometimes I do get a little annoyed by those that try to make those kinds of decisions for everybody else. So. But in general, I think our industry organizations and spokesmen and those that are involved in the food safety issues and health issues and so on and so forth, they do a good job. The chatter on the other side does get a little louder sometimes, and I think that there's a lot of misinformation out there, but so I'd take exception to that.
Well, Dina, you're considered, though, a special interest. I mean, when your organizations stand up and speak, that, you know, then you have people saying, well, that's just propaganda. You know, if they've got the checkout programs and they've got big PR agencies and so forth that are spinning the stories. So even when you try to stand up and present the other side, you're criticized for that as well, aren't you?
Thank you, That's a great question, Roger. And I had the opportunity, going back 10 years ago or so, to serve on the North Coast Regional Water Quality Control Board. And the purpose of my mentioning that is exactly that sort of special interest. And what I learned at that point in time was serving the public. And so I had to distance myself from our organizations that do, in essence, lobby on our behalf. One of the keys to me is recognizing that we have the University of California. And I really came away from that experience recognizing and valuing the science. And we're here today because we serve on a commission for the University of California. And I really think that as much of our policies with regards to health and environment, my interest and emphasis is more sort of on the environmental side of the equation, but I really think that we need to foster and listen to sound science and base decisions on sound science. We need to recognize that we only represent less than 2% of the entire population. So I think that it's incumbent upon us to sort of build bridges and cross traditional boundaries. And I think as individuals, we do belong to our trade organizations who have a different role. But I think as individuals, we can chart our own course and share our own opinions based on science. And I think that it's incumbent upon all of us to do that. So I'm not sure if I spoke in circles, but I certainly support my trade organizations and I'm a part of them, but I've also had to at times distance myself from them. But even at that, I really kept philosophically believe that food production and how we do it is necessary. And I think with science and using that as our guidepost, we can find a lot of commonalities.
Jack, let me ask you, there must be, when you take these issues and you go to your organizations, I mean, there's got to be disagreements. I mean, how messy is it to try to get a bunch of independent cattlemen to find themselves to the same place? I mean, there's many controversial issues that you see. You come up with a shared point of view. Does it work the way you want to see it work? Is it I'm just curious how you feel about that whole process of getting a shared view.
That's an interesting observation, Roger. And of course, I don't think that's unique necessarily to the cattle industry or to agriculture in general. Those kind of healthy disagreements and discussions and different points of view, they exist in virtually everywhere. And so I do think that for the most part, our state and national organizations and those that represent our industry from one end of the spectrum to the other, I think they do an adequate job of collaborating and finally coming to a solution that's to the benefit of all of us. I think one thing that both Dina and I would share is that coming from California, we are extremely aware of the political realities that face our industry as has faced the coal industry or mining in Nevada or anything else. I mean, you have those that agree with your position, you have those that may disagree or your detractors, and we just have to deal with it. But in California, the political reality is truly something that I think many of our comrades, if you will, in our industry don't understand, and I think both Dina and I do, and that's one of the most difficult things to deal with.
This has been the Farm to Table Talk podcast. Join us again for more conversations about our food, where it comes from, and how it's grown. Farm to Table Talk.